Welcome to A New Prescription, where we explore modern healthcare, cutting-edge medical research and technology, and the complexities of healthcare politics. Join us as we provide insights and solutions to help you navigate the American healthcare system.
Hi, this is Dr. Len Zwelling. I'm here with my son, Andrew, and we have a special guest today, but let me set up the special guest. One of the things that people forget is that all the medical devices used to diagnose and treat diseases must be approved by the FDA, just like the drugs are. But the approval processes are quite different. To explain these differences in the context of the development of a new catheter for the better diagnosis and treatment of coronary artery disease, we are speaking with Dr. Philip Rauschendorfer. Dr. Rauschendorfer is the Chief Scientific Officer of Intravascular Imaging, also called I3, and a research scientist at the Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston. Welcome, Dr. Rauschendorfer, and tell us a little bit about this special catheter, and then we'll get into what it does, why it's different, and how the FDA is going to try to get it approved.
Hello. Yeah, thank you for having me. So we are developing a new intravascular imaging catheter that combines intravascular ultrasound with near-infrared fluorescence. So it's a hybrid imaging device modality, and we're looking to overcome limitations that are associated with standard intravascular ultrasound by adding our fluorescence signals.
Tell me a little bit about how coronary artery disease is evaluated and diagnosed today.
Yeah, so there are non-invasive imaging modalities like standards are coronary angiography. A contrast agent is injected and then a CT scanner detects the contrast agent to project a Lumigram. But recently, more interest has been gained with intravascular imaging modalities like intravascular ultrasound and intravascular optical coherence tomography. The technology works like this. You have an intravascular imaging catheter, which houses a sensor at the tip of the catheter. This catheter is then inserted into the coronary arteries. And is connected to a so-called motor drive unit outside of the human body, which rotates the device and pulls it back at the same time. So in that way, you can perform a helical scan of the inside of the arterial wall and get high-resolution cross-sectional images of the vessels and the plaques, the coronary lesions.
Tell us why that's better and what the doctors are going to do with that information once they get it.
So it is better than coronary angiography in the terms that you get high resolution cross-sectional images. So the interventional cardiologist is able to review and measure important features like, for example, plaque burden, so the size of the coronary lesion, and is able to use that information to then make treatment decisions and also guide the treatment procedure, the stent implantations.
So they're going to be able to evaluate where a stent should go. Will it affect the kind of stent that goes in and opens up the vessel? And is there a likelihood that there's going to get, we'll have better results in terms of long-term survival of these patients? It's too early to tell. Obviously, we don't have the data yet, but at some point, that's the goal, that this kind of imaging would give doctors a better picture of the disease and a better way to treat it.
Yes, let me clarify. So intravascular ultrasound is a standard method that is already being used during coronary percutaneous interventions. So that's standard of care, I would say, right now. And there is already data that has shown that if you use intravascular imaging, like intravascular ultrasound, it improves long-term patient outcomes because stent placement is improved. However, there's still shortcomings of these standalone imaging modalities like ultrasound, For example, they lack any molecular or biological information of the disease. You only get a structural or anatomical view of the coronary lesions. But since coronary artery disease, for example, is a chronic inflammatory disease, you of course are interested to learn a little bit more about it in vivo and then optimize stent placement. So that's why we've developed this hybrid modality and our fluorescence signals. Our fluorescence modality can image an injectable nerve agent that can target important pathobiological markers of atherosclerosis like macrophages or accumulated lipids. And this combined hybrid information provides then a more comprehensive diagnosis to the interventional cardiologist. And in addition to that, it's sometimes also very time consuming to review all of these cross-sectional images during the surgeries. And that's why still, for example, in a lot of cases, I think up to 20%, the stents are not optimally placed, even with intravascular ultrasound guidance. And with fluorescence, we're now having an opportunity to simplify the data and almost create a roadmap. You can think of it as like a traffic light system, red, yellow, green, that highlights very easily where a lesion may have been missed and allows then the interventional cardiologist to visit that lesion again and maybe optimize the stent placement during the same procedure.
The catheter to date has not been used in humans yet?
Exactly. Our hybrid nerve IVUS catheter has so far been tested in preclinical animal models. And we've tested it in rabbits and in pigs. And we've done ex vivo human coronary imaging studies. So with coronaries that have been excised from patients and also carotid plaques.
So, well, the goal here is to get this in a place where you can test it in people. When, from the work you've done to date, does this catheter provide any additional safety questions, or does it appear to be just as safe as the catheters used today?
That's an interesting question. So we designed our imaging catheter in a way that it is very comparable and compatible with the existing intravascular ultrasound technology. So for example, a big factor is just the dimension of the device. These devices are very small. We're talking about a diameter of around 600 micrometers. Right? A human hair is around 100 micrometer in diameter. So they're tiny because they have to fit safely into coronary arteries and they need to be rotated and pulled back as explained. There is, in addition to the standard architecture of an intravascular ultrasound catheter, we have an optical fiber for our additional fluorescence imaging. So with that, there is a predicate device and a hybrid optical ultrasound imaging catheter. The technology works different than ours, but the components are similar. And this device is FDA approved, has been commercialized, and has been tested clinically. And that is our, let's say, safety comparison and safety standard for our application.
Let's talk a little bit about how you developed it. This was developed initially with NIH funding, is that correct?
That's exactly right. So as an early stage startup company, we've applied to NIH funding, which has served us great for, you know, doing early prototyping work and these proof of concept animal studies. And now we're switching gear a little bit because now we're looking into GMP manufacturing. And
what is GMP?
Good manufacturing practice.
Why is that?
Which is a necessary requirement for FDA approval, which just assures that medical devices are built up to the highest standards, reproducible, that they're safe. There's a quality system in place. And it's a very important and inherent part of the FDA approval process.
Now, you're going to require venture funding to go further, if I remember what we said in our discussion previously, that's a kind of path that is not at all unusual for drugs or for medical devices, for that matter. The one thing we do want to emphasize a little bit is that the NIH is under tremendous pressure right now from the administration, and a lot of cutbacks are occurring, which suggests that work like yours might be tougher to do in the future. But in your case, you're going to go to venture for the venture capital funding, but a public-private source of funding is not uncommon for devices, is it?
No, absolutely not. You have to think about it from a perspective that early stage medtech startup companies, there's obviously a high risk related to that from a funding or investment perspective, right? So what venture capital firms like to see if some of this is a little bit de-risked during all of that preliminary, you know, prototyping and preclinical work, so that when they come in, there's a proof of concept and data that supports the device. From a startup company point of view, NIH or public funding is also attractive because it's non-dilutive funding, right? So you don't have to give up equity early on and can develop a strategy.
I think I just want to stop for a second and emphasize to our listeners how important that pathway is and how much of the progress we've made medically is dependent upon that pathway, and how any decrease in NIH funding, which is being threatened right now, is undermining our ability to develop new drugs and devices as a country. And it's an important thing to emphasize. The other thing you mentioned is that your device is similar to a device that's on the market. And that brings us to the very important point here, which is the 510K exemption for devices. Why don't you tell us what that is and how important that is for you?
Yeah, absolutely. So in general, a company which intends to commercialize a new medical device, they must pursue one of the available FDA regulatory pathways to demonstrate that the device is safe and effective. And for devices for which a predicate device exists, they can rely on this 510K pre-market notification pathway, which results in a medical device clearance to market instead of a more significantly more onerous pre-market approval application pathway. So what needs to be demonstrated is that the device that's to be marketed is as safe and as effective, which is defined as substantially equivalent to an already legally marketed device, which is defined as the predicate device. And our catheter might qualify for this 510K pathway. In fact, we've done a pre-submission with the FDA, and they indicated that because there's a hybrid optical ultrasound imaging catheter, which is FDA approved and which is regarded substantially equivalent to our device and can therefore serve as a predicate device for our approval process.
Now, this rapid process, the 510K process, obviously is beneficial to patients, but there have been incidents where devices that have gone through the 510K pathway have later proven to be unsafe. That does happen. And so the FDA and the investigators have to be aware that the benefits of a facilitated pathway also come with some degree of increased risk compared to a more traditional pathway. But I think in the case of your catheter, that's probably not really germane here. I think your catheter is probably going to be just fine.
I can comment on that. So I looked up some numbers. There are over the 155,000 devices that have been approved since 1976. 99% have used this 510K pathway, okay? The 510K clearance is on average 2 to 3 times faster than the pre-market approval pathway. And there have been concerns and issues, especially when outdated or recalled devices are being used as predicate devices. There's this very famous example of these metal-on-metal hip implants.
Yes.
They used a predicate device, and that was outdated. And then during clinical trials, I think it was found out that these implants released some metal ions into the body, which caused tissue damage and required high revision rates.
Yeah, I think it was cobalt that came out of those things. Yeah.
Yeah, and nowadays, especially with, you know, artificial intelligence and machine learning processing algorithms, it's even more important to make sure that the predicate device is state of the art and can serve as an appropriate comparable device. Obviously, we are living in a very, you know, dynamic world in terms of these new technology innovations. And the FDA has recognized that, and they're currently modernizing this 510K pathway to promote reliance on modern device predicates that present a more accurate reflection of the state-of-the-art technology and current standards for safety and effectiveness.
Let's get back to your device in a second. Do you envision that your device will, in the long run, actually save money in the healthcare system at all because of the accuracy of the stent placement and you won't have to go back and do it again, that sort of thing?
Yeah, so what we expect is that with our improved guidance for the PCI procedures, we can, that would result in fewer unplanned re-interventions, which are very costly. We also expect to see a reduction in complications and adverse events like myocardial infections. It should lower the likelihood of also post-procedural issues, so shorter hospital stays. And also more appropriate use of these high cost devices like stents during the actual procedure. If you can place the first stent that you're using more optimized, you may not have to use a second or third to get the results that you're ultimately looking for. So we are expecting improved long-term outcomes, which should lower the downstream cost from heart failure. And there's about 1 million PCIs performed in the US per year. Already some of the initial cost studies have shown that using intravascular imaging in general can save up to $1,000 to $3,000 per patient. And we're looking to improve that even further with our more advanced hybrid device.
And your PCI is percutaneous?
Coronary intervention.
Right. Okay. I just want to make sure that we get that out there. Is it possible to use your technology in other parts of the body, do you think?
Yeah, that's such a good question. We're actually now very excited about advancing our imaging technology also in the peripheral space. So there's peripheral artery disease. There are complications in veins. And currently, there's only a modified version of intravascular ultrasound available, which operates at a lower frequency, which offers even less resolution. So we think we really could have a big impact there as well to help and detect atherosclerosis in peripheral vessels better.
I guess we've outlined the process, we've outlined your device. What else should our listeners, if they want to learn more about your catheter or the process by which you got your catheter approved, where could they go to see that?
So we have a website, and it's i3-nerve.com. And we outline the concept of a technology and especially highlight all the publications that have been peer-reviewed and published in scientific journals, which will give a great overview about the impact that our device may have in the future.
And what are you most excited about for your technology? Obviously, it has a lot of implications, both for coronary artery and peripheral artery disease. But what's the most exciting thing, do you think? Just getting it to market? Is that what's going to be the most fun?
Well, right now, you know, this has been, I've been studying or I've been working with this device for a long time in an academic setting. But now we're actually getting ready for our GMP manufacturing samples, which is very exciting because for the first time you get a tangible feel of having like an impact and improving, you know, clinical diagnosis. We're getting close to a design freeze and then submitting our samples. We have to outsource this GMP manufacturing. And once that's accomplished, we will do a pig safety study and wrap up our FDA application.
What's the timeline look like? When do you think you'll get to the FDA?
We're doing a big funding round right now. Of course, that's a determining factor. Because GMP manufacturing is very costly, but we're projecting to submit our FDA application within the next 2 years.
And I guess the bottom line question that I just can't help but ask is when you look back and look at the whole, how much did this all cost to get this far?
I think it's hard to put a number on this. I think the first publication that came out on this device was in 2011. So since 2011, NIH funding has allowed this research to investigate its impact. There have been, I think, five or six rounds of prototypes that we've developed over the years to improve the device over and over and validate it in sophisticated, you know, animal models. So it's hard for me to estimate a cost, but it's definitely been years and years of research in Europe and in the US that has made it possible for the startup company to be where it is today.
Well, certainly we're talking about millions of dollars, not thousands.
Yes.
Okay. I think the point I'm trying to make is that without the initial funding by the federal government with taxpayer dollars, this would not come to fruition. Yes, the funding in the private sector is critical, but without the NIH, there would be no catheter. And I think that's really one of the points. There is a facilitated process by which the FDA allows this stuff to get through and get out to the market, but there would be no device, there would be no invention without the NIH. And I think that at a time when the NIH frankly is under some degree of attack with its funding, I think this is an example of why the NIH is so critical. Andrew, you have anything from the point of view of a non-doc?
Yeah, I'm just sitting here in awe of both of you talking. My only question, well, one of my questions is, okay, funding is important from the government standpoint, from the NIH. Are we as taxpayers getting a return on those dollars, and somehow how are we getting those that back, or is it all going towards the company that's being funded?
Well, that's ultimately yeah, it's a great question, and I think the reason why the NIH is first of all, getting NIH funding is still a very competitive and difficult thing. You cannot just like apply for it. It's peer-reviewed, experts in the field review your application, and only the most innovative and most promising ideas get ultimately funded. And what they keep in mind is exactly what has the taxpayer ultimately from it. And my, I think, answer to that is if we're able to develop a device that, you know, hopefully there's a high chance, you know, that in everyone's, you know, closer circle, there's someone that suffers from coronary artery disease, right? It's the most common cause of death globally. If we're able to develop a device that help that improves treatment and patient outcome, then I think that would be a big return for taxpayers' money.
Okay. I agree.
And then, I mean, do you feel that because there's a limitation of the money, it puts you behind on other companies that are having governments that are supporting innovation of research? Are you starting to feel any of those pressures at all, or not really?
I think the U.S., I also have a comparison to Europe, right? I think the U.S. is still or historically has been an amazing place for startup companies, and it still is. We obviously have to see what the future now holds, but I think the US is a market leader in medical technology because of this NIH funding that's available to help and start companies and ideas. It supports high risk, high impact ideas, which not all of them obviously turn out to be successful, but there have been multiple examples of companies that had an amazing impact on global health. So,
and that's one of the things I worry about is if we stop funding breakthroughs like this, we're going to get behind in the world. And the innovations then are going to not come from us. So I see both sides of the equation where, you know, we as taxpayers want to see the ROI come. But, you know, as an American citizen, I do not want us to get behind technology wise with any of our enemies or, you know, and even our allies. I still would like us to be the center of innovation. And I know the startup community is really strong, so I'd like to continue that.
No argument from me, for sure. Dr. Rauschenderfer, thank you so much for your time. This is exactly what we wanted to cover, a specific device and the pathway to get it to the market. We look forward to having you back someday when you can tell us how great this thing is in the marketplace.
Awesome. I would love to. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you so much for joining A New Prescription. We're so excited that you stopped by. Please join us on our social pages at A New Prescription and also subscribe to our YouTube channel at A New Prescription YouTube. Remember, your health is the most important thing to you. We'll see you next time.